Welcome to Periodical Radio, the program about magazines and journals. I'm your host, Steve Black, librarian at the College of St. Rose in Albany, New York, and author of the book Serials in Libraries, Issues and Practices. Our program today is about Voices, Journal of the New York Folklore Society. This semi-annual periodical is a membership magazine of the New York Folklore Society. Quoting from a recent issue of Voices, "The New York Folklore Society is a nonprofit, statewide organization dedicated to furthering cultural equity and cross-cultural understanding through programs that nurture folk cultural expressions within communities where they originate, share these traditions across cultural boundaries, and enhance the understanding and appreciation of folk culture." Voices' mix of research articles and stories, interviews, and other informal content is unusual for a periodical. The spring-summer 2006 issue has 7 feature articles and 12 departments and columns in 48 pages. The longest article is 7 pages. Many are 1 page. The design is simple but attractive, with black and white photos and subtle use of 2 tones of yellow to highlight titles and sidebars, and text is divided into 3 columns per page. It's printed on heavyweight glossy paper, and the text and photos are sharp and easy to read. The content of Voices is remarkable in the broad diversity of topics addressed in the articles and columns. For example, in one recent issue, there are scholarly pieces about a community quilt and about college students' trips to spooky places. One article is about folklore literature and subscription full-text databases. Another is about cab drivers in New York City, and one about Michigans, a type of chili dog popular in Plattsburgh. There's a piece about filming the creation of a Buddhist sand mandala, and one that reminisces about a grandma, and an obituary of a folk musician. Regular columns include Upstate, Downstate, Foodways, Bookshelf Essentials, Good Spirits, New York Folklore Society News, Eye of the Camera, and Book Reviews. The New York Folklore Society's website at www.nyfolklore.org contains a wealth of information that complements their journal. Their website includes an index of the journal and its predecessors, New York Folklore, published 1975 through 1998, and New York Folklore Quarterly, 1945 through 1974. Some full-text content from the journals is available on their website, but they do not have cover-to-cover full text online. My guest today is Ellen McHale, Executive Director of the New York Folklore Society. Ellen holds a PhD in folklore and folklife from the University of Pennsylvania. She's a native New Yorker and has worked for 17 years as a folklorist in many areas of upstate New York and western Massachusetts. Her past positions include Director of the Schoharie County Historical Society and the Old Stone Fort Museum, Director of the Shaker Heritage Society, and Assistant Director of the Folklife Center of the International House of Philadelphia. She was a Fulbright Scholar in Sweden and has taught folklore courses at Empire State College and Hudson Valley Community College in Troy, New York. Ellen, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
First of all, our show is about Voices, the Journal of New York Folklore. What is Voices about?
Well, it's the mission of the magazine is to include the voices of people within New York State and their traditional arts and culture. So we try to bring in articles that have to do with first-person use of folklore material, rather than looking at it from the outside and looking in and making an evaluation or a scholarly thesis on the folklore. That's included in the articles, but in a downplayed sense. We really want to hear the voices of the folklore itself coming through.
I see. I guess now is a good time to talk for a moment about just what folklore is.
Well, it's depending on who you ask, the definition can be more or less expansive, but folklore is we like to say it's the artistic ways that people make sense of everyday life. So they take the experiences that they have and the alliances and allegiances that they have, and they create a way to share that knowledge together within the group. So groups are important in folklore. People share folklore from person to person. Sometimes it's historical. Sometimes things are passed down through families or through communities. But also folklore is what we like to say is emergent. It's coming all the time. So if there's a, for example, a catastrophic event like 9/11, there's folklore that happens after that, stories that get told that are passed from one person to another to help make sense of that event.
And Voices records that and preserves it?
Yes. It's a peer-reviewed magazine journal. So we solicit some articles, but for the most part, we have people who send things to us. So the content for each issue is somewhat dependent on what people submit to us. But yes, we do have articles that deal with historical material, but we also have many articles that deal with contemporary life in New York State.
How long has Voices been published?
Well, Voices itself is relatively new. It's since 2000 was the inauguration of Voices, but it actually is a continuation of a much older journal, and we've been publishing for 60 years. We started out just as the New York Folklore Quarterly. It came out in a quarterly manner, four times a year, and then it slowly was collapsed into one issue a year for several years. And in 1999 and 2000, we decided to create Voices to try to, first of all, to bring it back to the quarterly sense. When the quarterly was founded in 1945, people wanted to have a lot of solicitations from the field. They wanted people who were ordinary people in New York State, not scholars, to be able to submit material about their own history, their own background, their own communities. And so it was, that was the mission of the first journal. And then when it moved, it became more scholarly. And then in 2000, we decided to move it back to the intent of the original New York Folklore Quarterly. So that's when Voices was born.
One of the questions I had was, Voices is an unusual publication in that it is a mix of popular first-person narratives and scholarly material. What makes that mix work?
I think the scholarly material works because it's good scholarship. It's peer-reviewed, so we make sure that the scholarship is good, but we also demand, maybe that's a little too strong, we ask authors to keep the language jargon-free so people can read it, and if you don't have any background in folklore or a little background in folklore, you should be able to follow along with what the author's trying to convey. And we also think that the voices of people who possess the folklore, that's not really the right word, but the people who have the folklore and write it down, we include, for example, we've had people who write pieces about their own background. That just is so rich in what's in the content of it. So we think those two things really work well together. And so whatever level you come at the subject, it should be able to speak to you.
I see. I was really struck when I was looking at a recent issue of the variety of things that were covered in it. There was a scholarly piece on trips to spooky places, an obituary, stories about hot dogs and grandmothers and ponds and quilts and cab drivers. Is that what makes folklore interesting?
I think so. That's why I'm interested in it, is because you can really look at what everything around you, and you can sort of draw us out of that. It's the variety in life is what I find fascinating, and I think that shows up in Voices. Mm-hmm. And whether we have articles from city, urban environments, we have articles from rural environments, there's a commonality of what folklore is and folk traditions within someone's functioning life.
Who are your readers?
We're actually worldwide. We have subscribers who are libraries in academic institutions throughout the world. We send it to India, we send it to Turkey, we send it to Sweden. So that's our core academic libraries, I think. Then we have individual members who receive the journal, who probably 65% are based in New York State. But we have people who are also subscribers who are from other states within the union and Canada. So I think sometimes people join the New York Folklore Society to get the journal because they're native New Yorkers and they've moved to Florida, for example, and they want to keep touch with what's happening in New York State. But it's a mix between pretty much half academic libraries and half individual subscribers.
To be a subscriber, though, you're a member. Is that correct?
Yes.
How did you come to the decision that you wanted to do it that way? And what are the benefits to the society of having the journal subscription tied directly to being a member?
Well, that's a hard question because it's a little bit debatable. I'm not sure we actually ever discussed it, and it's something that could be discussed. It's always been the journal itself, when it was formed in 1945, was always a benefit of membership. So when you joined the New York Folklore Society in 1944, you got the journal. That was, and we've had people that we know join just because they like the journal. Now it's a little iffier because we do other things as a society. In 1990, we moved from being a solely academic organization to one that has a service component. So we serve traditional artists in the state. We serve people who are academic folklorists and people who are working in what we call the public sector, applied anthropologists, ethnomusicologists, and other folklorists. So you can join the Folklore Society for those service reasons and not even really care about receiving the journal, but you do get it. So we do have, it's a mixed group, and I don't actually know the answer to the question is which, if people do join and just don't want the journal at all, we don't really know. But it's a benefit of membership, and it always has been.
I see. Thank you. Voices has an acquisitions editor, a managing editor, photography editor, and an editorial board. How do these folks and what do these folks do, and how do you coordinate all the work?
Everybody has a specific job. When we designed Voices in 1999, it took us a whole year of really examining what we wanted to have happen and what we thought was important. And we felt, first of all, photography was important, that our journal was never heavily photographic, and we felt that photos needed to be highlighted. And they had to be good. So that's when we decided to have a photography editor. So that person actually is the quality control person for the photos and also helps us choose the images that might want to be in an article, because we do like to have photos in every article. The acquisitions editor is a folklorist. She has a PhD in folklore, and her job is to find articles, to vet the original. If people send in submissions unsolicited, she does the first sort of line of whether this is appropriate for the journal. And then after all that work is done, she sends it to our managing editor, who basically does a lot of all the copy editing. So I'm actually, as the executive director of the Folklore Society, a little bit out of the picture until I see the final. I usually get a table of contents, and so then I know everybody's done their job, and then I see the first proof. So it's always a surprise when it comes, and even though I know what the articles are going to be, to see them all laid out and what photos are there, it's kind of fun. But it is a group effort, and everybody works well together, and they meet and we also have a designer who is involved in the early stages of putting each issue together, and they actually all live in central New York. So they all meet without me and do their thing.
And it works. Very good. Do you have a personal all-time favorite piece, article, that was published in Voices?
I don't myself.
Okay.
But I can tell you that there are certain issues, because what happens after the journal is published, we put it on the web. We don't put whole articles on the web. We haven't made that leap yet, but we have almost whole articles. So someone reads it, and they sometimes have to come back to us and say they'd like the whole thing. But we have abstracts and excerpts of articles on the web. And I can tell you which ones have been popular, because I get responses all the time. We had an article several years ago about the Keynesian era, the Sweet 15 birthday party that happens in the Latino, mostly Puerto Rican community when a girl reaches 15. And I get still several in a month requests for that article or requests for me to give information on how to make a quinceañera for somebody's daughter. So that's one that has struck a really respondent chord. And the other one that comes to mind is we had an article, I think maybe in the first issue or the second issue, about a man who makes güiros, which is a instrument that's played. This person, I'm blocking where he's from. I think maybe the Dominican Republic, but he plays merengue music, and it's a scraper instrument that's made out of tin and has holes, and they're in a design, but you can make, it's a rhythm instrument. Anyway, to make long story short, that article, we always get requests through our website asking us where they can buy a güiro. So that's another one I know people read a lot. So there's certain articles that come to mind that have really struck some chord someplace.
So you have a record on your website of all of the articles that have been published in the three publications since 1945?
1945, yeah. We have an index, actually. So you can go to the New York Folklore Society website, and you can search on a topic or subject, and it will pop up all the articles that we've ever published. And some of the back issues we still have, so we can access them. And if we don't have them, we can help you find them.
Is that an important mission of the publication, to make the archival information available?
I think so, yes. We've thought, and we probably will down the line, as the quarterlies, as our back issues disappear, and some issues we don't have any more of, we'll begin to put the whole articles on the website so people can actually get them online. But we haven't made that leap yet. But we do feel that it's important to have all this material available.
Have you discussed whether you'll continue having a print publication once you've done that?
Not seriously. I know that's the wave of the future.
Maybe.
We haven't made that leap yet. I personally like something in my hands. Who knows? Eventually maybe that will become what happens and everything's electronic. But
so you see that as a conversation down the road, but it hasn't been a topic that you've seriously looked at yet.
Right. It's been a small conversation and not a serious conversation ever. So down the road, it might become more serious.
We librarians still like the print, but who knows what will happen in the future. What are the most important or urgent issues for folklorists?
Right now?
Yes.
I'm seeing in the last 10 years a real shrinking of our field. And for me, that's an urgent issue. I see universities with folklore programs that that grew up in the 70s. I was actually probably a child of that era when folklore was burgeoning. It was the tail end of the folk revival, and people were interested in folklore and folk music and folk art. And there was a different feeling on campuses, too. And those programs that started at that point, I see now those professors retiring and not being replaced. So within New York State, that's a real issue. There are fewer programs than there were. And so I feel that for undergraduates, if you don't get exposed to the subject and the discipline at the undergraduate level, it makes it more difficult to enter into the graduate level of inquiry. So that's the biggest issue. I'm not sure that's what you expected, but for me, that's the issue in folklore right now, is a real shrinking of the field. And I don't know whether it's cyclical and that will change, but I think academic institutions are moving away from, maybe this is a broad overstatement, but some of the issues that are in folklore are being, at this point, not in the forefront.
What issues would those be?
Well, certainly not multiculturalism, because that is an issue I think that's in the forefront. But I don't know, maybe it's I'm seeing this is back to basics, much more of a focus on the classics and the sort of the canon of Western literature, for example, the great books approach to learning as opposed to looking at folklore, which is really a coming from the people and from a much less lofty and higher echelon of social economic status, population.
I see. What do you like best about being executive director of the society?
I like being able to be in the place where I look at the trends and that's happening nationally, because we're the New York Folklore Society, because we're a state organization, not a governmental state organization, but because we are the New York Folklore Society, we actually in several ways represent New York State, and there are similar organizations in other states. So I like being in the position where I can see what's happening nationally, but also see what's happening within our state and try to figure out what the trends are and where we can, as a service organization, develop programs that assist to help people in their work, whatever that is. So for example, we are working right now, we're putting together a forum on immigrant and ethnic artists in the state, and there are lots of issues with immigration right now, and so we'll be putting we had a forum in Brooklyn a few months ago, we're doing another one in Syracuse to really bring together people who work with immigrants and know those immigration issues and how it's affecting their lives and their art and their ability to do art, and get people together to talk about what kinds of solutions we can come up with. So I like the activist part of things, I think.
That sounds like it leads right to my next question of what are the greatest challenges of your position in the New York Folklore Society?
The greatest challenges for any nonprofit is financial. At this point, we operate with a lot of grant support and some earned income. So that's our biggest challenge probably for me is to keep an organization solvent and running and vibrant, and also marketing and getting the word out. That's the other biggest issue is to get the New York Folklore Society known. We're sort of a niche, and to find out where that niche is and to get our word out to the people who really are interested, that's the other biggest challenge.
Does your journal Voices bring in some income? I know it's tied to membership, but is that a significant portion?
Yeah, I think so. If it is. I mean, if you say the membership is the journal subscription, then it is a significant part of our operating budget.
How do you see the future of Voices? Is it a healthy future?
I think so. We certainly we don't have any scarcity of articles. We're never in the position since Voices started in 2000 of looking at an issue and saying, oh no, we have holes in it. So that's a good thing, is we always have enough material, and we certainly see our subscription base growing. So that's the other good thing. So yes, I see it as a healthy publication.
Excellent. Is there anything you'd like to add? Any comments of anything we haven't discussed yet?
No, I don't think so. Well, actually, I can just say, you know, we welcome writing. And when we celebrated our 60th anniversary last year, we had a whole issue devoted to writing, and we had a conference about it. If anybody is listening to this and would like to submit to us, we welcome submissions all the time.
Very good. Thank you, Ellen.
Sure, thank you.
To become a member of the New York Folklore Society and receive your own subscription to Voices, you may send a check for $35 payable to the New York Folklore Society, P.O. Box 764, Schenectady, New York, 12301. As mentioned at the top of our show, the Society's website at www.nyfolklore.org contains a wealth of information about folklore and the Society. Many thanks to Ellen McHale for taking the time to visit with me. Thank you for listening to Periodical Radio. I'm your host, Steve Black.